What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear. Strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Welcome back to Macabre Mondays, where mystery meets the macabre with your favorite deadly host. I'm Alet. Today's episode is extra special because for the very first time, we're stepping into the supernatural and spine-chilling world of fiction with none other than New York Times and internationally best-selling author J.D. Barker. If you're unfamiliar, J.D. is known for his gripping, edge-of-your-seat stories that just mix thriller, horror, and a touch of the supernatural. He's perhaps best known for his breakout hit, The Fourth Monkey, but more recently, his upcoming novel, Something I Keep Upstairs, which is inspired by a real-life haunted house. I've been absolutely loving it thus far. So stick around, because later in the episode, we'll share how you can win an overnight stay at this very haunted location that inspired his most recent book. And believe me when I tell you, you don't want to miss the opportunity. JD, welcome to Macabre Mondays. It's fantastic to have you here.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I've got to say, I'm clearly already a big fan of your work, as you know. But wow. I've been really enjoying your writing style and the way that you tell stories. Thriller, horror, and paranormal books are pretty much like all that I read, with the occasional self-growth books sprinkled in to keep the balance. But your work definitely hits that sweet spot for me. And I'm sure listeners would love to get to know you better. So maybe you could start off with just by sharing a bit of your journey. How did you first start writing? And what about, you know, what brought you from those early days to becoming the best-selling author that you are now?
Oh, wow. So my overnight success took about 30 years from start to finish. It's one of those things, like I grew up reading, you know, like I loved books as a kid, was constantly had my head buried in them. I loved writing. I started writing when I was little. I've got a sister who's 15 months younger than me. I used to write up like short stories, and I would staple them, and I created a library in my room, and she'd check them out, and I'd charge her late fees. So like this dates back a really long time.
Wow.
And my parents always encouraged writing, but they always added the caveat, it's a fantastic hobby, but you can't make a living at it. You have to get a real job. So I did what I was expected to do. I went off to college. I got a couple of degrees, got a corporate job. But I would come home and write at night to stay sane. I worked at, do you know what a book doctor and a ghostwriter is?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So I did that for 23 years. I basically helped other people fine tune their novels, rewrite them and help them get ready for publication. And I did that while I was doing the corporate gig. My last real job, I was a chief compliance officer at a brokerage firm, which is as horrible as it sounds. But I would come home and I would work on these books. And then over those couple of decades, I had six different ones that hit the New York Times list that all came out with other people's names on the cover that I had written, which gets old after a while. So I set out to finally start writing my own books.
Wow. That's incredible, though. And is that kind of the catalyst of why you were just, what am I doing? Like, I'm doing this for everyone.
Yeah,
else.
You know,
for me.
That sixth one hit up. You know, my wife pulled me aside and she's like, "Listen, I know you want to become a full time author. Let's figure out a way to do it." But we were kind of stuck because I had the corporate gig. I had a really good salary, and we had the trappings of that. We had a big house, we had cars, we had a boat. You know, so we had to sustain that lifestyle.
Right.
So she came up with this crazy plan. We sold everything that we owned. We bought a tiny little duplex in Pittsburgh, rented out one side to some tenants, and we lived in the other side, and basically got our expenses down to nothing so that I could live off of savings, you know, long enough to write that first book.
Wow, that's amazing. Honestly, I mean, that's what's so great about wives, you know? They're so supportive. Yeah. I tell my husband that the whole time.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, if she hadn't pushed me to do that, I'd probably still be sitting behind that desk, you know, doing a job that I absolutely hated, you know, because you get comfortable. It's tough to walk away from that.
A lot of times I'm like, what am I doing? I feel like I want to do something more. And then you get kind of caught up in that whole ifs of it all. You know, you're working, you're kind of cushioned. It's very comfortable, you know, and it's kind of hard to step out of the bounds, because then everyone's like, what are you doing? It's like, I'm trying to be happy. I'm trying to pursue a passion, you know, but, and super inspiring. I love hearing all that from your story of how you started and where you are now. And since we're all about the sinister, the strange and the spooky here, I'd love to just kind of just ask you, like, what's the first ghost story or creepy tale you remembered that really just kind of stuck with you as a kid? You know, something that made you look over your shoulder or had you sleeping with the lights on?
Yeah, so I grew up without a TV in the house. So like I said, we were reading at a very early age. And I started off with like Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew and stuff like that. And then I read some of the classics. My mom owned an antique store and we used to go to a lot of garage sales and yard sales. And I remember going to one and I saw a book sitting on top of a box of books and it had like a really creepy looking cover on it. It was Dracula, you know, from Bram Stoker.
Wow.
I was 8 years old. I picked it up. I read the back. I was like, there's no way my mom's going to let me buy this. It looks too scary. But she let me buy it and I read it crazy fast. And I think I slept with the lights on for like the next 2-3 weeks after that. And I think that's what actually hooked me, you know, on writing and reading, because it's the first time I really had like a big emotional reaction to a book. And I've been chasing that feeling ever since, either in stuff that I read or I write.
Wow, that's amazing, too, because you ended up working with Dacre Stoker later in the future.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so with my first novel, Forsaken, it was up for the Bram Stoker Award for Best Debut Novel. And while I was at the conference to accept that, Dacre Stoker, who's Bram's great-grandnephew, pulled me aside and he said, listen, the family has read your book. We love your writing style. We're familiar with your history as a ghostwriter and a book doctor.
Right.
We've been trying to find somebody to write a prequel to Dracula for a very long time using Bram's original notes. Would you like to do it? And, you know, the answer to that is obviously yes.
Like, duh.
You know, so I jumped both feet into that project and that was a lot of fun.
Wow, that's incredible. I love, it's kind of also full circle how crazy it is, like, you know, from your young,
this
is what a small world in reality. So it's crazy. And like, you're clear. I mean, you're known for your writing gripping thrillers with dark and supernatural twists and like building off of that. Like, what was it that just kind of pulled you into this genre? Was it just because you discovered, you know, Dracula at that thrift store? Or what was it that just kind of made you feel more of like, this is what I want to write for the rest of my life?
I think because the book scared me so much, you know, like I honestly, I've been trying to replicate that ever since, you know, like when I write a book like Something I Keep Upstairs, it actually took me 4 years to write this book. And normally I can write a book in 3 or 4 months. Like it's not normally a long process, but I kept coming into these scenarios where I would write something that either freaked me out or I would discover something about the house because it is a real house.
Right.
And, you know, it would make me question whether I really want to put this down on paper or not. And I kept putting the book aside and having to come back to it. It's by far the scariest thing I've ever written.
Oh, my God. OK, you're giving me goosebumps because every time like I've been reading it. And anytime like I finish a chapter, I have to go straight to my husband. I'm like, Tom, here's the update. Like, here's the synopsis of what's going down. And so but it's funny, too, because I was first introduced to your work through The Fourth Monkey, which I have to admit, I'm a big fan of the 4MK series now, and it had me saying the F word quite a few times as I was reading it. How do you?
Oh, no.
I mean, in a good and a bad way, you know?
It's funny because when, you know, I write a lot of books with James Patterson, and like, I think we were halfway through the first one. He's like, you use the F word way too much. I was like, you got to dial it back. And I'm like, but it's cops, you know, cops swear.
They did, yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
You got to keep it real.
No, for sure. And I'm originally from New Jersey. So to me, it's very, yeah, my husband's like, make sure you tone it down on the sailor mouth. I'm like, I would never.
It's funny because now I've got a 7-year-old daughter and like I've learned to dial it back, you know, at home. Like we don't curse in front of her, you know, just for that reason. And it's funny because it just jumps out at me that much more now when people swear, like, you know, I look around real quick to make sure none of the little ones are nearby.
Yeah, that's so funny. Yeah. Well, like, so how did you manage to kind of get into the minds of such unsettling and disturbing, but yet realistic characters like in 4MK?
You know, that was another one where there were scenes that I wrote that really creeped me out. It's hard to explain. Like when I'm writing a story, I come up with the characters first. I basically get to know them as well as I know, you know, like a real person in my life. And then I come up with the plot and I drop these, you know, essentially real people into that scenario and I let them tell me the story. You know, like if you do it properly, like, you know, everybody's going to have a different reaction to a particular thing that happens. You know, so you follow along. So for me, it's a lot like watching a movie that's just playing out in my head and I'm writing it down as fast as I possibly can. You know, with 4MK, like I had no idea where that story was going. I let the characters tell me, you know, it's and that's part of the fun. You know, I discover it right along with the reader.
Man, I love that. And I mean, that really just kind of keeps you drawing to like, oh, what else can I do here? Where else can we go? Like, what, you know, if they're telling you the story themselves. So that's such an interesting way to look at it. That's great. And so where do you usually draw inspiration for creating the characters in your book?
It comes from all over the place. I've got an app on my phone called Simple Note, and one of the documents is literally called Ideas. And I drop anything I can possibly think of in there. And to give you an idea, like I had a husband and wife character, Brennan and Abby Hollander, that I had in there for years. I knew they were going to be, you know, like roughly in their 20s, late 20s, early 30s, married for about 10 years, both working separate jobs and kind of living separate lifestyles. You know, they see each other first thing in the morning, they go off to work, they come home at night, you know, watch an hour on Netflix, and then they kind of go to sleep. And, you know, after 10 years, like I wanted their marriage to be a little stale. And I knew that, you know, at some point, Brendan would come really close to cheating, but not quite get there. Right. The two of them basically have a heart-to-heart talk and realize we want to try and save this. And I knew I wanted to start whatever story I had with them in a therapist's office, you know, basically talking about what happened and how they're going to move past it. I had them for years just sitting there in that document. And then one night, my wife and I were talking over dinner, and she does real estate. She had just bought a house in Georgia, and it's big. It had 7 bathrooms in it. And we were talking about renovating it. And I just casually mentioned this company called Bath Fitters. You know, we've all seen the commercials. They come in one day and retrofit your bathroom. But that's all we did is we discussed it. We talked about it. And that night on our phones, we both started seeing ads for Bath Fitters. We started seeing commercials on TV for Bath Fitters. And I started to research this and realized that when we basically agree to the terms of service in our phones, we give them permission to listen 24/7. Sure. So like my phone is sitting next to me. It's listening to this conversation. And they grab keywords out of the air, and they'll use that to target market you. So I started thinking about, you know, where does that information go? Who controls it? So I basically put that together with Brendan and Abby. So at one point, they're sitting in the therapist's office, and the therapist recommends they download an app. It's called Sugar and Spice. It's essentially Truth or Dare for adults. And, you know, it starts off with very benign little things to try and, you know, spark their marriage up. But at one point, Abby loads a dare up. And it says, would you kill a total stranger to save someone you love? And she clicks yes on it. And a map comes up with a pin and a timer. You know, and that's essentially the you know, the basis of the story. But, you know, like it took both of those parts to come together. It's almost like chocolate and peanut butter.
Right.
You know, you two totally unexpected things come together and it just works.
Wow, that's amazing. Is the story out yet? Are we still?
Yeah, that one came out last year. It's called Behind a Closed Door. There's a movie in the works that, you know, in Hollywood.
Wow, amazing. Look at you, JD. Where are they, where are they planning on streaming it? Do you have any more information on the...
At this point, like, they're working on a feature film. They've got a writer attached to it. They're working on the script.
Wow.
But I've got no idea where it's going to end up. I've got 8 different projects in what I call various stages of Hollywood hell. And, like, literally, like, nothing has actually gotten filmed yet. But, like, they keep sending me option payments, which is almost as good as, you know... Yeah, so sooner or later, you know, it's a numbers game. Something will get to the screen. So I'm just waiting like everybody else.
Right. No, clearly. That's awesome, though. I can't wait. I did see that was one of the books that you've written before. And so it's on my queue. I've got a couple things I got to get through. But so clearly, as you've been telling me, every creative has their quirks, right? And I mean, I have my own, you have your own. What's like your must-have item or ritual when you're writing these scenes, or like, you know, what is it that gets you going, especially if you know, like, I've got this with me, or if I know I'm in this mood?
This is going to sound weird, but it comes all the way back when I was writing in the corporate days. You know, like, I had to squeeze out words for whatever I was working on, like, in between life. You know, I was working 60 to 80 hours a week, you know, so I would take time out to write, you know, standing in line at the grocery store or in the car at a traffic light, you know, wherever I could. I listen to a thunderstorm soundtrack whenever I want to get in that mood. So it's literally just white noise. But like when I hear that sound, my brain immediately snaps into writer mode, and it knows this is what we're doing now.
Wow, you're like
it's like a it's a Pavlov's dog thing. You know, like I've been doing that, you know, for 30 years now.
Wow.
And like I can be anywhere if I put my headphones on and I hear that sound. Like, you know, I just start going.
Wow, that's awesome. I mean, that's a good way to put it too. I feel like any time that I'm trying to really kind of immerse myself in a book or whatever the case may be, I try to put a soundtrack that I feel fits that type of mood vibe. And that's just how it works. I created one for something I keep upstairs. So it helps me as I keep reading it, just kind of make the anticipation a lot better. Well, I want to shift gears and talk about your newest book, of course, because that's what we've been talking about now, because clearly it's a great one. And since I've already started reading the advanced copy that you and the team sent over and can personally say I'm absolutely chilling and addictive, I am loving it. How do you balance the lines between fact and fiction when incorporating ghost stories into books?
Ooh, and that was a particularly tricky one because, you know, the house is real.
Right.
You know, I actually live in Newcastle, New Hampshire, which is where the book is based. And the house itself, you know, like I live on an island, and that the island where the house is right off the coast of our island. And like, I see it every day. I go for a run around our island and I stop on the beach and I look out over the water and I can see the house, you know, from my book. You know, so like I incorporated a ton of real information in this one. You know, when I started actually researching that house and realized, you know, learned some of the things that had happened out there, you know, I'd put as much of it into the book as I possibly could. But like, those are the things that gave me pause. And when you get to the author's note, I kind of explain this at the end, you know, because like when I turned that into my agent, her first inclination is, well, you have to change all these real places. You know, you can't use any of that. And I did. I changed, you know, the name of the town. I changed, you know, the names of people. But ultimately, I changed it all back because, you know, it is historical fact, you know, and I think, you know, when you read the author's note, I particularly point out like what is real and what isn't. And the funny thing is, like, a lot of the stuff as you're reading the book that you think is fiction is actually the real stuff.
Right.
And that's what really gets you. And you'll get there. If you're not done with the book yet, you haven't hit the author's note. But the author's note tends to get you the most.
Yeah, I've been experiencing that as I keep reading. There's a lot of like, my husband will say I'm like resurrecting because I'll be in bed reading and then I get up. I'm like, oh, I'm like, you don't understand what I just read. I don't like, I'm like, I'm lost. What's going on? So I mean, needless to say, I'm excited to continue finishing it off and I'll definitely be probably sending you my thoughts afterwards. Or Kate, it's okay. I know you're busy, but so now that your new novel, Something I Keep Upstairs, clearly it's set to release on May 13th and it revolves around a real haunted house, like you said. How did this kind of haunted house become the place that you're like, this is going to be my next book?
Well, initially, you know, like we moved to Newcastle, my wife and I, and, you know, like I go for a run every day. I finish up my writing around 3 and then I do a lap around the island. It's 4 miles. You know, so when I crossed the beach, I would see this island out there. It's a quarter mile off our coast and there's only one house on it, which is the house from my book.
Right.
And, you know, in my brain, like I have what I call the what if gene. You know, like you look out at this house, you can't really tell what's going on. It's just far enough away where, you know, it looks like somebody may live out there.
Right.
Maybe they don't. You know, every once in a while there's a light on, but you can't really tell what's happening. So I basically start to fill in the blanks and make up my own story for it. And that's essentially where it came from. And I started to research the house. I found out that it used to be a Coast Guard life-saving station.
Right.
And a local guy took it upon himself to try and restore it because it was completely falling apart. It was totally dilapidated. So he reached out to the town of Kittery, which actually owned it, and ultimately negotiated a deal, raised a ton of money, and he's been rebuilding it over the years. So I got a hold of him, and he took me out there on his boat before I knew anything about the house. And got off on the island, went into the house, and he's showing me around, and like I'm standing in there, and I just wanted to leave. I wanted to get out. Like I was like the hair on the back of my neck was standing up. You know, like I don't know if you've ever been in a place like where you just you don't want to be.
Yes.
But like that was happening, but like there was no basis for it. There was nothing scary going on. There was no reason to feel that way. But like every instinct in me was like, you need to get out of this place.
Wow.
And then when I went home, I started to research some of the things that had happened out on that island. And I learned like back when yellow fever was you know, prominent out here, they used it as a quarantine zone. So they used to put people out there to, you know, to die of yellow fever. During the Spanish-American War, if they captured a vessel, they would dock it out there and they'd force everybody to stay on the boat until they either died of starvation or disease. And then they would take the boat because that's what they really wanted. And they fed all these bodies to the sharks because like that the water up there is filled with great whites. It's a it's a little inlet and it's a little warmer. So the fish and the seals and stuff come in, which brings the sharks. But like when you're standing on the beach looking out at it, it's this beautiful little house. You know, the sun is trickling off the water. You know, everything looks perfect. It looks like a postcard.
Right.
But when you really start digging into the history, you know, like there's some frightening stuff that's happened out there. And that's just, you know, the last couple hundred years. Who knows what happened before that?
Yeah, definitely. And it's funny because as I was reading it, I'm like, all these locations you're mentioning sounded like I've heard of them before. And then I'm like, I need to go on Google GPS. And then I'm on the satellite view and I'm like, oh, there's a house. And then I'm like, let me see a view from this side and let me see a view from that. And I'm like, oh, that's why it's Maine. And it's like a whole thing. So I love that. That kind of part of it also was super immersive. And it was just kind of fun to be able to see it because, you know, if you're creating it, something from real and also something from fake. So it's kind of like combining the two is amazing. Now, without any spoilers, of course, can you share maybe a particularly eerie moment that you encountered during your research, or maybe while you were writing the book, that really just kind of stuck out to you?
The one that we're still trying to figure out, I found a newspaper article from 1972. Somebody went camping out on the island, because you can get there by boat. You just have to be very careful. There's a lot of granite and stuff. But he was out there camping. He found two bodies buried in the sand right on the beach there. So you know, that immediately tricked, you know, all the law enforcement officers come in, try to figure it out.
Right.
The island is right on the coast of Maine and New Hampshire. So it kind of became this hot potato. Nobody wanted this particular case. So they brought in the FBI and the FBI took it over. There's only one newspaper article about the entire thing. You know, there's two bodies found on the beach. But there's a picture in that story, and they basically outline all of this. So I reached out to the local police department, and they had no record of it. I reached out to the Kittery Police Department. They had no record of it.
Really?
So I reached out to a friend at the FBI, and she tried to pull the files, and they have no record of it. So, you know, like these bodies basically vanished. Nobody identified them, or if they did, nobody knows where the information is. There was a guy in the picture. He was the DA at the time.
Okay.
I actually tracked him down in real life. He's still a working attorney. He told me he didn't remember it. You know, but like, I have a hard time believing somebody could stand on an island standing over two bodies, picturing the newspaper, and not remember that. You know, so like, it felt very conspiracy to me, but you know, there's probably a logical explanation. But like, at this point, all these years later, nobody knows who those two people were. They don't know how they got there. They don't know where they went. So I've still got people looking at that. I made contact with somebody else who runs another FBI branch office, and he's trying to reopen the case.
That's insane. That is a hell of a, my God, wow. And so
it's practically a story by itself, you know?
Yeah, I was going to say, is that like inspiration for the next part? Because man, that's crazy. And also reading the book, I'm like, what's real, what's not? That's kind of you telling me that's your experience, that no one can even tell you that it even happened, but you remember it, but then it's, ooh, we're going down a dark tunnel there. I love it. No, that's amazing. That's awesome. Well, not amazing. I'm sorry about the two dead bodies, but you know what I mean.
We all are. If they figure it all out, I'll be thrilled. Like I don't like to leave open and you know strings dangling out there.
Yeah.
Like it's just a mystery nobody has solved yet.
For sure, definitely. Now, JD, I wanted to sneak in some fun macabre themed questions to ask you that I know the listeners and me, especially me probably, would love to hear the answers to. But if ghosts are real, okay, I know I believe they are. Who's one historical figure that you'd absolutely not want haunting your house?
Wow. Not want one haunted. Because I've actually got, you know, living in New England, there's a lot of weirdness here.
I was going to say.
My wife and I looked at this house three times and nobody told us there was a cemetery in the backyard. We actually found it later.
No way.
No ghosts in the house. Geez, you know, I think I've got a feeling being a ghost would be boring. You know, and if they actually haunt people, that's probably why. They're probably trying to get, you know, something to liven up whatever is going on in their world. So I don't think I'd want somebody creative, you know. So I think of like, you know, Edgar Allan Poe or somebody like that. Like I wouldn't want him haunting my house.
Yeah.
You know, reading Bram Stoker's journals, you know, like I had access to all that when I wrote the prequel to Dracula.
Right.
He had some extremely dark thoughts. That's another one that I probably wouldn't want anywhere near me.
Okay, good. Yeah, that sounds good. I remember when I was like, every time I get together like a set of questions, I'm like, how would I answer them? Because I'm like, No, I wouldn't want that either. I think my choice was like Lizzie Borden. I'm like, please, I just don't need that. I don't need that energy at the house.
No, nobody needs that.
Yeah, no, and I'm like, I don't even have to explain it. Yeah. Well, what's one item that you would never want to see mysteriously move by itself in your home?
Ooh, I've got a couple of them. You can't see it on here. So I've got a cane off in the side that's got a sword in it. That's really old. It belonged to a guy named Arminius Vanbury, who's actually in Dracul. He was a real person. So that one kind of freaks me out. I've got a couple items like that. I've got a very old ring. Kind of see over my shoulder, like the silver handle of it. I'm a big fan of Supernatural. That's actually one of the props from the TV show Supernatural.
That's
it's
awesome.
an angel blade.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so any of these things in my office, if they were to get moved and I wouldn't like that, they would probably freak me out.
Gotcha. That's valid. That's a very valid answer. Okay, now if you could sit down for coffee with one fictional horror or thriller character, it could be your own or someone else's, who would it be and what would you want to ask them?
Ooh, I don't know if it would be a thriller character, but I'd love to talk to Charles Dickens.
Ooh.
He was one of my first reads after I finished up the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew. I discovered Charles Dickens, and like Great Expectations is still my all time favorite novel.
Yeah.
And I'd love to just talk to him, you know, and kind of pick his brain.
Wow. I'd love that. It's looking like you're not going to sit down for coffee with him. You guys are going to have a long dinner, walk on the beach.
maybe some tea.
Some tea. Yeah. All right. So what's your go-to spooky or thriller comfort movie? The one that you could probably just watch again and again.
Trying to think. Super scary. I honestly like Alien. I don't know if that was really, I mean, it's more sci-fi than horror, I mean, everything about it, you know, like even the tagline, in space, nobody can hear you scream, you know, like that, that completely sums it all up.
Eerie.
That's one I've watched over and over. I've kind of gotten lucky. Do you remember a movie called Flatliners from the 90s?
It sounds somewhat familiar, but no.
Yeah, so it came out in 1990. It had a huge cast. It had Kiefer Sutherland, Julia Roberts, Billy Baldwin, yes. Oliver Platt. It's about med students who decide to kill each other one at a time and then bring themselves back to try and figure out if there's any kind of life after death. It's one of my all-time favorite movies, and it stood the test of time. And recently, one of the guys who wrote it, his name's Peter Filardi. He's actually on one of my other projects. Uh-huh. We started talking about 2 years ago, and I told him I had an idea to reboot the franchise. And at the time, he didn't have the rights. And he called me back about a year ago and said, you know what, JD, I just got the rights back if you still want to do it.
No way.
So we've actually got a book coming out. We literally just finished the first draft. The ARC copies are with the attorneys and stuff going through them right now.
Awesome.
But I'm getting the opportunity to reboot one of my favorite scary movies from the 90s.
Look at you. Wow. Little JD Barker, who was like had no TV, is probably looking up at you right now. And it's like, yeah, you go, man. Well, for many of our listeners, I'm pretty sure they're feeling inspired by your journey after hearing all of this. I know you've talked openly about going from, you know, the unfulfilling corporate job to pursuing your passion for writing full time. Can you share a bit about that experience making the leap? And, you know, and if you have any advice that you'd want to give to someone contemplating a similar big life change, pursuing a passion?
I mean, the one thing I tell everybody is just to chase that dream, you know, because it's so like the years just fly by. And before you know it, you're going to be sitting on a porch in a rocking chair, you know, wondering what if, you know, like I could have done this, I could have done that. And,
right. You
know, you're better off just pulling that Band-Aid off and just trying. And you know, like it took like the scenario that my wife and I created, you know, we were living off of savings. Like I literally had to make it work or I would have to go back to another job that I didn't like, you know. So like I think that kind of pressure really helped.
Right.
You know, being in the cushy job kind of hurt me because I got so comfortable. You know, Stephen King worked in like laundromats and like really horrible jobs, you know, because he wanted the writing thing to be this brass ring. And I think he, you know, because of that, he chased it and got there a little bit sooner.
Right.
So don't give up on your dream. If there's something you want to do, you know, just pursue it. Life is too short.
It's so true. I feel like I've been putting myself through a lot of inspirational quotes and stuff. And one of the ones that always stick out to me when somebody asks these type of questions, it's like, well, if not now, then when? You know, like, when are you? Well, like you said, right when you're in the rocking chair, you might not have the time, the energy, or even the will to be able to do the things that you'd want to do now. So why, if not now, then when? So for sure, I love it. So inspirational. I might put that on a bumper sticker, so I'll let you know. But now, as I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, for our brave listeners, JD and his team is having a thrilling and exciting giveaway. You and three friends could win an overnight stay at an actual haunted house that inspired JD's latest novel, Something I Keep Upstairs. That makes its debut on May 13th, just a few weeks away. All the details and the giveaway link will be in this episode's description. I'll also be posting the link in bio on Macabre Monday socials. And don't forget to pre-order your copy of the book. It's definitely a must read. You won't forget it. I know I'm eager to get my hands on a physical copy myself. So looking forward to it. But before we wrap up today's episode, JD, what's next on your horizon? Any exciting new projects you'd like to share with us or that you can share with us?
The Flatliners one that I just mentioned, you're going to see that probably in the press very shortly. We announced it when we first started. Now that the book is done, you know, there's probably some film news coming out very soon.
Right.
So you're going to see that one come up next. And I'm in the middle of another book with James Patterson, which is always fun.
Right. Which is that the writer that just released?
That one just came out. That came out when was it? March 17th, so about 2-3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Hit the list at number two. We got stuck behind Rebecca Yarros on the New York Times bestseller
list.
Yeah, we beat her on a bunch of other lists, but not the New York Times list. So
next time. Next book, just add a dragon somewhere.
That's the thing. I literally called Patterson up when we hit the list. I was like, we need to have a dragon. Like that's where we failed.
No, seriously. No, that's funny. Well, lastly, how can our listeners best find you online, follow your work, and stay updated on your upcoming books and event?
Easiest place to find me is jdbarker.com, and I'm on all the social medias at jdbarker.
JD, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you today. Thanks for giving us a peek into your fascinating, and let's admit it, slightly terrifying world that you're in. We'd absolutely love to have you back on the show in the future, whether it's for another book release or just to talk about more creepy things. You're always welcome to come back to the Macabre Mondays world.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you to our listeners for joining us today on a special Macabre Mondays episode. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. You can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. We'll see you next Monday for another sinister, strange, and spooky episode. Stay tuned. More mystery is just around the corner. But until then, stay curious and stay safe. Bye. JD, throw your bye. You have to say bye. Bye.
Bye. What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear: strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane. Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.